Is such an economy? For this is actually the case with the present world. The continual motion of matter, therefore, in less than infinite transpositions, must produce this economy or order. And by its very nature, that order, when once established, supports itself for many ages, if not to eternity. But wherever matter is so poised, arranged, and adjusted as to continue in perpetual motion, and yet preserve a constancy in the forms, its situation must, of necessity, have all the same appearance of art and contrivance which we observe at present. A defect in any of these particulars destroys the form, and the matter of which it is composed is again set loose, and is thrown into irregular motions and fermentations, till it unite itself to some other regular form. Suppose that matter were thrown into any position by a blind, unguided force. It is evident that this first position must in all probability be the most confused and most disorderly imaginable, without any resemblance to those works of human contrivance which, along with a symmetry of parts, discover an adjustment of means to ends and a tendency to self-preservation. Suppose that the actuating force, whatever it be, still continues in matter. Thus the universe goes on for many ages in a continued succession of chaos and disorder. But is it not possible that it may settle at last? May we not hope for such a position, or rather be assured of it from the eternal revolutions of unguided matter, and may not this account for all the appearing wisdom and contrivance which is in the universe? It seems that something like this might work, but Hume couldn't quite take Philo's daring foray seriously. His final verdict? A total suspense of judgment is here our only reasonable resource. A few years before him, Denis Diderot had also written some speculations that tantalizingly foreshadowed Darwin. I can maintain to you that monsters annihilated one another in succession, that all the defective combinations of matter have disappeared, and that there have only survived those in which the organization did not involve any important contradiction, and which could subsist by themselves and perpetuate themselves. Diderot, 1749. Cute ideas about evolution had been floating around for millennia, but like most philosophical ideas, although they did seem to offer a solution of sorts to the problem at hand, they didn't promise to go any farther, to open up new investigations, or generate surprising predictions that could be tested, or explain any facts they weren't expressly designed to explain. The evolution revolution had to wait until Charles Darwin saw how to weave an evolutionary hypothesis into an explanatory fabric composed of literally thousands of hard-won and often surprising facts about nature. Darwin neither invented the wonderful idea out of whole cloth all by himself, nor understood it in its entirety, even when he had formulated it. But he did such a monumental job of clarifying the idea and tying it down so it would never again float away that he deserves the credit if anyone does. The next chapter reviews his basic accomplishment. Chapter 1. Before Darwin, a mind-first view of the universe reigned unchallenged. An intelligent God was seen as the ultimate source of all design, the ultimate answer to any chain of why questions. Even David Hume, who deftly exposed the insoluble problems with this vision and had glimpses of the Darwinian alternative, could not see how to take it seriously. Chapter 2. Darwin, setting out to answer a relatively modest question about the origin of species, described a process he called natural selection, a mindless, purposeless, mechanical process. This turns out to be the seed of an answer to a much grander question. How does design come into existence? Chapter 2. An idea is born. 1. What is so special about species? Charles Darwin did not set out to concoct an antidote to John Locke's conceptual paralysis, or to pin down the grand cosmological alternative that had barely eluded Hume. Once his great idea occurred to him, he saw that it would indeed have these truly revolutionary consequences. But at the outset, he was not trying to explain the meaning of life or even its origin. His aim was slightly more modest. He wanted to explain the origin of species. In his day, naturalists had amassed mountains of tantalizing facts about living things and had succeeded in systematizing these facts along several dimensions. Two great sources of wonder emerged from this work, Mayer, 1982. First, there were all the discoveries about the adaptations of organisms that had enthralled Hume's Cleanthes. All these various machines and even their most minute parts are adjusted to each other with an accuracy which ravishes into admiration all men who have ever contemplated them. Second, there was the prolific diversity of living things, literally millions of different kinds of plants and animals. Why were there so many? This diversity of design of organisms was as striking in some regards as their excellence of design, and even more striking were the patterns discernible within that diversity. Thousands of gradations and variations between organisms could be observed, but there were also huge gaps between them. There were birds and mammals that swam like fish, but none with gills. There were dogs of many sizes and shapes, but no dog cats or dog cows or feathered dogs. The patterns called out for classification. And by Darwin's time, the work of the great taxonomists, who began by adopting and correcting Aristotle's ancient classifications, had created a detailed hierarchy of two kingdoms, plants and animals, divided into phyla, which divided into classes, which divided into orders, which divided into families, which divided into genera, the plural of genus, which divided into species. Species could also be subdivided, of course, into subspecies or varieties. Cocker spaniels and basset hounds are different varieties of a single species. Dogs, or Canis familiaris. How many different kinds of organisms were there? Since no two organisms are exactly alike, not even identical twins, there were as many different kinds of organisms as there were organisms. But it seemed obvious that the differences could be graded, sorted into minor and major, or accidental and essential. Thus, Aristotle had taught, and this was one bit of philosophy that had permeated the thinking of just about everybody, from cardinals to chemists to costermongers. All things, not just living things, had two kinds of properties. Essential properties, without which they wouldn't be the particular kind of thing they were, and accidental properties, which were free to vary within the kind. A lump of gold could change shape ad lib and still be gold. What made it gold were its essential properties, not its accidents. With each kind went an essence. Essences were definitive, and as such, they were timeless, unchanging, and all or nothing. A thing couldn't be rather silver or quasi-gold or a semi-mammal. Aristotle had developed his theory of essences as an improvement on Plato's theory of ideas, according to which every earthly thing is a sort of imperfect copy or reflection of an ideal exemplar or form that existed timelessly in the Platonic realm of ideas, reigned over by God. This Platonic heaven of abstractions was not visible, of course, but was accessible to mind through deductive thought. What geometers thought about and proved theorems about, for instance, were the forms of the circle and the triangle. Since there were also forms for the eagle and the elephant, a deductive science of nature was also worth a try. But just as no earthly circle, no matter how carefully drawn with a compass or thrown on a potter's wheel, could actually be one of the perfect circles of Euclidean geometry, so no actual eagle could perfectly manifest the essence of eaglehood, though every eagle strove to do so. Everything that existed had a divine specification which captured its essence. The taxonomy of living things Darwin inherited was thus, itself, a direct descendant, via Aristotle, of Plato's essentialism. In fact, the word species was at one point a standard translation of Plato's Greek word for form or idea, eidos. We post-Darwinians are so used to thinking in historical terms about the development of life forms that it takes a special effort to remind ourselves that in Darwin's day, species of organisms were deemed to be as timeless as the perfect triangles and circles of Euclidean geometry. Their individual members came and went, but the species itself remained unchanged and unchangeable. This was part of a philosophical heritage, but it was not an idle or ill-motivated dogma. The triumphs of modern science, from Copernicus and Kepler, Descartes and Newton, had all involved the application of precise mathematics to the material world. And this, apparently, requires abstracting away from the grubby accidental properties of things to find their secret mathematical essences. It makes no difference what color or shape a thing is when it comes to the things obeying Newton's inverse square law of gravitational attraction. All that matters is its mass. Similarly, alchemy had been succeeded by chemistry once chemists settled on their fundamental creed. There were a finite number of basic, immutable elements, such as carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and iron. These might be mixed and united in endless combinations over time, but the fundamental building blocks were identifiable by their changeless, essential properties. The doctrine of essences looked like a powerful organizer of the world's phenomena in many areas. But was it true of every classification scheme one could devise? Were there essential differences between hills and mountains, snow and sleet, mansions and palaces, violins and violas? John Locke and others had developed elaborate doctrines distinguishing real essences from merely nominal essences. The latter were simply parasitic on the names or words we chose to use. You could set up any classification scheme you wanted. For instance, a kennel club could vote on a defining list of necessary conditions for a dog to be a genuine our-kind spaniel. But this would be a mere nominal essence, not a real essence. Real essences were discoverable by scientific investigation into the internal nature of things, where essence and accident could be distinguished according to principles. It was hard to say just what the principled principles were, but with chemistry and physics so handsomely falling into line, it seemed to stand to reason that there had to be defining marks of the real essences of living things as well. From the perspective of this deliciously crisp and systematic vision of the hierarchy of living things, there were a considerable number of awkward and puzzling facts. These apparent exceptions were almost as troubling to naturalists as the discovery of a triangle whose angles didn't quite add up to 180 degrees would have been to a geometer. Although many of the taxonomic boundaries were sharp and apparently exceptionless, there were all manner of hard-to-classify intermediate creatures who seemed to have portions of more than one essence. There were also the curious higher-order patterns of shared and unshared features. Why should it be backbones rather than feathers that birds and fish shared? And why shouldn't creature with eyes or carnivore be as important a classifier as warm-blooded creature? Although the broad outlines and most of the specific rulings of taxonomy were undisputed, and remain so today, of course, there were heated controversies about the problem cases. Were all these lizards members of the same species or of several different species? Which principle of classification should count? In Plato's famous image, which system carved nature at the joints? Before Darwin, these controversies were fundamentally ill-formed and could not yield a stable, well-motivated answer because there was no background theory of why one classification scheme would count as getting the joints right, the way things really were. Today, bookstores face the same sort of ill-formed problem. How should the following categories be cross-organized? Bestsellers, science fiction, horror, garden, biography, novels, collections, sports, illustrated books. If horror is a genus of fiction, then true tales of horror present a problem. Must all novels be fiction? Then the bookseller cannot honor Truman Capote's own description of In Cold Blood, 1965, as a non-fiction novel. But the book doesn't sit comfortably amid either the biographies or the history books. In what section of the bookstore should the book you are listening to be shelved? Obviously, there is no one right way to categorize books. Nominal essences are all we will ever find in this domain. But many naturalists were convinced on general principles that there were real essences to be found among the categories of their natural system of living things. As Darwin put it, they believe that it reveals the plan of the Creator, but unless it be specified whether order in time or space, or what else is meant by the plan of the Creator, it seems to me that nothing is thus added to our knowledge. Origin, page 413. Problems in science are sometimes made easier by adding complications. The development of the science of geology and the discovery of fossils of manifestly extinct species gave the taxonomists further curiosities to confound them. But these curiosities were also the very pieces of the puzzle that enabled Darwin, working alongside hundreds of other scientists, to discover the key to its solution. Species were not eternal and immutable. They had evolved over time. Unlike carbon atoms, which, for all one knew, had been around forever in exactly the form they now exhibited, species had births in time, could change over time, and could give birth to new species in turn. This idea itself was not new. Many versions of it had been seriously discussed, going back to the ancient Greeks. But there was a powerful Platonic bias against it. Essences were unchanging, and a thing couldn't change its essence, and new essences couldn't be born, except, of course, by God's command in episodes of special creation. Reptiles could no more turn into birds than copper could turn into gold. It isn't easy today to sympathize with this conviction, but the effort can be helped along by a fantasy. Consider what your attitude would be towards a theory that purported to show how the number 7 had once been an even number long, long ago, and had gradually acquired its oddness through an arrangement whereby it exchanged some properties with the ancestors of the number 10, which had once been a prime number. Utter nonsense, of course. Inconceivable. Darwin knew that a parallel attitude was deeply ingrained among his contemporaries, and that he would have to labor mightily to overcome it. Indeed, he more or less conceded that the elder authorities of his day would tend to be as immutable as the species they believed in. So, in the conclusion of his book, he went so far as to beseech the support of his younger readers. Whoever is led to believe that species are mutable will do good service by conscientiously expressing his conviction, for only thus can the load of prejudice by which this subject is overwhelmed be removed. Origin, page 482. Even today, Darwin's overthrow of essentialism has not been completely assimilated. For instance, there is much discussion in philosophy these days about natural kinds. An ancient term, the philosopher W.V.O. Quine, 1969, quite cautiously resurrected for limited use in distinguishing good scientific categories from bad ones. But in the writings of other philosophers, natural kind is often sheep's clothing for the wolf of real essence. The essentialist urge is still with us, and not always for bad reasons. Science does aspire to carve nature at its joints, and it often seems that we need essences or something like essences to do the job. On this one point, the two great kingdoms of philosophical thought, the Platonic and the Aristotelian, agree. But the Darwinian mutation, which at first seemed to be just a new way of thinking about kinds in biology, can spread to other phenomena and other disciplines, as we shall discuss. There are persistent problems both inside and outside biology that readily dissolve once we adopt the Darwinian perspective on what makes a thing the sort of thing it is. But the tradition-bound resistance to this idea persists. 2. Natural selection, an awful stretcher. It is an awful stretcher to believe that a peacock's tail was thus formed, but believing it, I believe in the same principle, somewhat modified, applied to man. Charles Darwin, letter quoted in Desmond and Moore, 1991, page 553. Darwin's project in Origin can be divided in two. To prove that modern species were revised descendants of earlier species, species had evolved, and to show how this process of descent with modification had occurred. If Darwin hadn't had a vision of a mechanism, natural selection, by which this well-nigh inconceivable historical transformation could have been accomplished, he would probably not have had the motivation to assemble all the circumstantial evidence that it had actually occurred. Today, we can readily enough imagine proving Darwin's first case, the brute historic fact of descent with modification, quite independently of any consideration of natural selection or indeed any other mechanism for bringing these brute events about. But for Darwin, the idea of the mechanism was both the hunting license he needed and an unwavering guide to the right questions to ask. The idea of natural selection was not itself a miraculously novel creation of Darwin's, but, rather, the offspring of earlier ideas that had been vigorously discussed for years and even generations. For an excellent account of this intellectual history, see R. Richards, 1987, in the bibliography, available in the downloadable PDF. Chief among these parent ideas was an insight Darwin gained from reflection on the 1798 Essay on the Principle of Population by Thomas Malthus, which argued that population explosion and famine were inevitable, given the excess fertility of human beings, unless drastic measures were taken. The grim Malthusian vision of the social and political forces that could act to check human overpopulation may have strongly flavored Darwin's thinking, and undoubtedly has flavored the shallow political attacks of many an anti-Darwinian. But the idea Darwin needed from Malthus is purely logical. It has nothing at all to do with political ideology, and can be expressed in very abstract and general terms. Suppose a world in which organisms have many offspring. Since the offspring themselves will have many offspring, the population will grow and grow geometrically until inevitably, sooner or later, surprisingly soon in fact, it must grow too large for the available resources of food, of space, of whatever the organisms need to survive long enough to reproduce. At that point, whenever it happens, not all organisms will have offspring. Many will die childless. It was Malthus who pointed out the mathematical inevitability of such a crunch in any population of long-term reproducers, people, animals, plants, or for that matter, Martian clone machines, not that such fanciful possibilities were discussed by Malthus. Those populations that reproduce at less than the replacement rate are headed for extinction, unless they reverse the trend. Populations that maintain a stable population over long periods of time will do so by settling on a rate of overproduction of offspring that is balanced by the vicissitudes encountered. This is obvious, perhaps, for houseflies and other prodigious breeders, but Darwin drove the point home with a calculation of his own. The elephant is reckoned to be the slowest breeder of all known animals, and I have taken some pains to estimate its probable minimum rate of natural increase. At the end of the 5th century, there would be alive 15 million elephants, descended from the first pair. Origin, page 64. Since elephants have been around for millions of years, we can be sure that only a fraction of the elephants born in any period have progeny of their own. So the normal state of affairs for any sort of reproducers is one in which more offspring are produced in any one generation than will in turn reproduce in the next. In other words, it is almost always crunch time. At such a crunch, which prospective parents will win? Will it be a fair lottery in which every organism has an equal chance of being among the few that reproduce? In a political context, this is where invidious themes enter, about power, privilege, injustice, treachery, class warfare, and the like. But we can elevate the observation from its political birthplace and consider in the abstract, as Darwin did, what would, must, happen in nature. Darwin added two further logical points to the insight he had found in Malthus. The first was that at crunch time, if there was significant variation among the contestants, then any advantages enjoyed by any of the contestants would inevitably bias the sample that reproduced. However tiny the advantage in question, if it was actually an advantage, and thus not absolutely invisible to nature, it would tip the scales in favor of those who held it. The second was that if there was a strong principle of inheritance, if offspring tended to be more like their parents than like their parents' contemporaries, the biases created by advantages, however small, would become amplified over time, creating trends that could grow indefinitely. More individuals are born than can possibly survive. A grain in the balance will determine which individual shall live and which shall die. Which variety or species shall increase in number, and which shall decrease or finally become extinct. Origin, page 467. What Darwin saw was that if one merely supposed these few general conditions to apply at crunch time, conditions for which he could supply ample evidence, the resulting process would necessarily lead in the direction of individuals in future generations who tended to be better equipped to deal with the problems of resource limitation that had been faced by the individuals of their parents' generation. This fundamental idea, Darwin's dangerous idea, the idea that generates so much insight, turmoil, confusion, anxiety, is thus actually quite simple. Darwin summarizes it in two long sentences at the end of chapter 4 of Origin. If during the long course of ages and under varying conditions of life, organic beings vary at all in the several parts of their organization, and I think this cannot be disputed, if there be, owing to the high geometric powers of increase of each species, at some age, season, or year, a severe struggle for life, and this certainly cannot be disputed, then considering the infinite complexity of the relations of all organic beings to each other and to their conditions of existence, causing an infinite diversity in structure, constitution, and habits to be advantageous to them, I think it would be a most extraordinary fact if no variation ever had occurred useful to each being's own welfare, in the same way as so many variations have occurred useful to man. But if variations useful to any organic being do occur, assuredly individuals thus characterized will have the best chance of being preserved in the struggle for life, and from the strong principle of inheritance, they will tend to produce offspring similarly characterized. This principle of preservation I have called, for the sake of brevity, natural selection. Origin, page 127. This was Darwin's great idea. Not the idea of evolution, but the idea of evolution by natural selection. An idea he himself could never formulate with sufficient rigor and detail to prove, though he presented a brilliant case for it. The next two sections will concentrate on curious and crucial features of this summary statement of Darwin's. 3. Did Darwin explain the origin of species? Darwin did wrestle brilliantly and triumphantly with the problem of adaptation, but he had limited success with the issue of diversity, even though he titled his book with reference to his relative failure, The Origin of Species. Stephen Jay Gould, 1992, page 54. Thus, the grand fact in natural history of the subordination of group under group, which from its familiarity does not always sufficiently strike us, is in my judgment fully explained. Charles Darwin, Origin, page 413. Notice that Darwin's summary does not mention speciation at all. It is entirely about the adaptation of organisms, the excellence of their design, not the diversity. Moreover, on the face of it, this summary takes the diversity of species as an assumption. The infinite complexity of the relations of all organic beings to each other and to their conditions of existence. What makes for this stupendous, if not actually infinite, complexity is the presence at one and the same time, and competing for the same living space, of so many different life forms, with so many different needs and strategies. Darwin doesn't even purport to offer an explanation of the origin of the first species, or of life itself. He begins in the middle, supposing many different species with many different talents already present, and claims that starting from such a mid-stage point, the process he has described will inevitably hone and diversify the talents of the species already existing. And will that process create still further species? The summary is silent on that score, but the book is not. In fact, Darwin saw his idea explaining both great sources of wonder in a single stroke. The generation of adaptations and the generation of diversity were different aspects of a single complex phenomenon, and the unifying insight, he claimed, was the principle of natural selection. Natural selection would inevitably produce adaptation, as the summary makes clear, and under the right circumstances, he argued, accumulated adaptation would create speciation. Darwin knew full well that explaining variation is not explaining speciation. The animal breeders he pumped so vigorously for their lore knew about how to breed variety within a single species, but had apparently never created a new species, and scoffed at the idea that their particular different breeds might have a common ancestor. Ask, as I have asked, a celebrated raiser of Hereford cattle, whether his cattle might not have descended from longhorns, and he will laugh you to scorn. Why? Because though they well know that each race varies slightly, for they win their prizes by selecting such slight differences, yet they ignore all general arguments and refuse to sum up in their minds slight differences accumulated during many successive generations. Origin, page 29. The further diversification into species would occur, Darwin argued, because if there was a variety of heritable skills or equipment in a population of a single species, these different skills or equipment would tend to have different payoffs for different subgroups of the population, and hence these subpopulations would tend to diverge, each one pursuing its favored sort of excellence, until eventually there would be a complete parting of the ways. Why, Darwin asked himself, would this divergence lead to separation or clumping of the variations instead of remaining a more or less continuous fan-out of slight differences? Simple geographical isolation was part of his answer. When a population got split by a major geological or climatic event, or by haphazard emigration to an isolated range, such as an island, this discontinuity in the environment ought to become mirrored eventually in a discontinuity in the useful variations observable in the two populations. And once discontinuity got a foothold, it would be self-reinforcing, all the way to separation into distinct species. Another, rather different, idea of his was that in intraspecific infighting, a winner-take-all principle would tend to operate. For it should be remembered that the competition will generally be most severe between those forms which are most nearly related to each other in habits, constitution, and structure. Hence, all the intermediate forms between the earlier and later states, that is, between the less and more improved state of a species, as well as the original parent species itself, will generally tend to become extinct. Origin, page 121. He formulated a variety of other ingenious and plausible speculations on how and why the relentless culling of natural selection would actually create species boundaries, but they remain speculations to this day. It has taken a century of further work to replace Darwin's brilliant but inconclusive musings on the mechanisms of speciation with accounts that are to some degree demonstrable. Controversy about the mechanisms and principles of speciation still persists. So in one sense, neither Darwin nor any subsequent Darwinian has explained the origin of species. As the geneticist Steve Jones, 1993, has remarked, had Darwin published his masterpiece under its existing title today, he would have been in trouble with the Trades Description Act. Because if there is one thing which Origin of Species is not about, it is the origin of species. Darwin knew nothing about genetics. Now we know a great deal. And although the way in which species begin is still a mystery, it is one with the details filled in. But the fact of speciation itself is incontestable, as Darwin showed, building an irresistible case out of literally hundreds of carefully studied and closely argued instances. That is how species originate, by descent with modification from earlier species, not by special creation. So in another sense, Darwin undeniably did explain the origin of species. Whatever the mechanisms are that operate, they manifestly begin with the emergence of variety within a species and end, after modifications have accumulated, with the birth of a new descendant species. What start as well-marked varieties turn gradually into the doubtful category of subspecies, but we have only to suppose the steps in the process of modification to be more numerous or greater in amount, to convert these forms into well-defined species. Origin, page 120. Notice that Darwin is careful to describe the eventual outcome as the creation of well-defined species, Eventually, he is saying, the divergence becomes so great that there is just no reason to deny that what we have are two different species, not merely two different varieties. But he declines to play the traditional game of declaring what the essential difference is. It will be seen that I look at the term species as one arbitrarily given for the sake of convenience to a set of individuals closely resembling each other, and that it does not essentially differ from the term variety, which is given to less distinct and more fluctuating forms. Origen, page 52. One of the standard marks of species difference, as Darwin fully recognized, is reproductive isolation. There is no interbreeding. It is interbreeding that reunites the splitting groups, mixing their genes and frustrating the process of speciation. It is not that anything wants speciation to happen, of course. Dawkins, 1986A, page 237. But if the irreversible divorce that marks speciation is to happen, it must be preceded by a sort of trial separation period in which interbreeding ceases for one reason or another, so that the parting groups can move further apart. The criterion of reproductive isolation is vague at the edges. Do organisms belong to different species when they can't interbreed, or when they just don't interbreed? Wolves and coyotes and dogs are considered to be different species, and yet interbreeding does occur, and, unlike mules, the offspring of horse and donkey, their offspring are not in general sterile. Dachshunds and Irish wolfhounds are deemed to be of the same species, but unless their owners provide some distinctly unnatural arrangements, they are about as reproductively isolated as bats are from dolphins. The white-tailed deer in Maine don't in fact interbreed with the white-tailed deer in Massachusetts, since they don't travel that far. But they surely could if transported, and naturally they count as of the same species. And finally, a true-life example seemingly made to order for philosophers, consider the herring gulls that live in the northern hemisphere, their range forming a broad ring around the North Pole. As we look at the herring gull moving westwards from Great Britain to North America, we see gulls that are recognizably herring gulls, although they are a little different from the British form. We can follow them as their appearance gradually changes as far as Siberia. At about this point in the continuum, the gull looks more like the form that in Great Britain is called the lesser black-backed gull. From Siberia across Russia to northern Europe, the gull gradually changes to look more and more like the British lesser black-backed gull. Finally, in Europe, the ring is complete. The two geographically extreme forms meet to form two perfectly good species. The herring and lesser black-backed gull can be both distinguished by their appearance and do not naturally interbreed. Mark Ridley, 1985, page 5. Well-defined species certainly do exist. It is the purpose of Darwin's book to explain their origin, but he discourages us from trying to find a principal definition of the concept of a species. Varieties, Darwin keeps insisting, are just incipient species. And what normally turns two varieties into two species is not the presence of something, a new essence for each group, for instance, but the absence of something. The intermediate cases, which used to be there, which were necessary stepping stones, you might say, but have eventually gone extinct, leaving two groups that are, in fact, reproductively isolated as well as different in their characteristics. Origin of Species presents an overwhelmingly persuasive case for Darwin's first thesis. The historical fact of evolution as the cause of the origin of species, and a tantalizing case in favor of his second thesis, that the fundamental mechanism responsible for descent with modification was natural selection. Level-headed readers of the book simply could no longer doubt that species had evolved over the eons, as Darwin said they had. But scrupulous skepticism about the power of his proposed mechanism of natural selection was harder to overcome. Intervening years have raised the confidence level for both theses, but not erased the difference. Elligard, 1958, provides a valuable account of this history. The evidence for evolution pours in, not only from geology, paleontology, biogeography, and anatomy, Darwin's chief sources, but of course from molecular biology and every other branch of the life sciences. To put it bluntly but fairly, anyone today who doubts that the variety of life on this planet was produced by a process of evolution is simply ignorant, inexcusably ignorant, in a world where 3 out of 4 people have learned to read and write. Doubts about the power of Darwin's idea of natural selection to explain this evolutionary process are still intellectually respectable, however, although the burden of proof for such skepticism has become immense, as we shall talk about. So, although Darwin depended on his idea of the mechanism of natural selection to inspire and guide his research on evolution, the end result reversed the order of dependence. He showed so convincingly that species had to have evolved that he could then turn around and use this fact to support his more radical idea, natural selection. He had described a mechanism or process that, according to his arguments, could have produced all these effects. Skeptics were presented with a challenge. Could they show that his arguments were mistaken? Could they show how natural selection would be incapable of producing the effects? Or could they even describe another process that might achieve these effects? What else could account for evolution, if not the mechanism he had described? This challenge effectively turned Hume's predicament inside out. Hume caved in because he could not imagine how anything other than an intelligent artificer could be the cause of the adaptations that anyone could observe. Or more accurately, Hume's Philo imagined several different alternatives, but Hume had no way of taking these imaginings seriously. Darwin described how a non-intelligent artificer could produce those adaptations over vast amounts of time, and prove that many of the intermediate stages that would be needed by that proposed process had indeed occurred. Now the challenge to imagination was reversed. Given all the telltale signs of the historical process that Darwin uncovered, all the brush marks of the artist, you might say, could anyone imagine how any process other than natural selection could have produced all these effects? So complete has this reversal of the burden of proof been that scientists often find themselves in something like the mirror image of Hume's predicament. When they are confronted with a prima facie, powerful, and undismissible objection to natural selection, we will consider the strongest cases in due course, they are driven to reason as follows. I cannot yet see how to refute this objection or overcome this difficulty. But since I cannot imagine how anything other than natural selection could be the cause of the effects, I will have to assume that the objection is spurious. Somehow, natural selection must be sufficient to explain the effects. Before anyone jumps on this and pronounces that I have just conceded that Darwinism is just as much an unprovable faith as natural religion, it should be borne in mind that there is a fundamental difference. Having declared their allegiance to natural selection, these scientists have then proceeded to take on the burden of showing how the difficulties with their view could be overcome. And time again, they have succeeded in meeting the challenge. In the process, Darwin's fundamental idea of natural selection has been articulated, expanded, clarified, quantified, and deepened in many ways, becoming stronger every time it overcame a challenge. With every success, the scientists' conviction grows that they must be on the right track. It is reasonable to believe that an idea that was ultimately false would surely have succumbed by now to such an unremitting campaign of attacks. That is not a conclusive proof, of course, just a mighty persuasive consideration. One of the goals of this audiobook is to explain why the idea of natural selection appears to be a clear winner, even while there are unresolved controversies about how it can handle some phenomena. 4. Natural selection as an algorithmic process. What limit can be put to this power? Acting during long ages and rigidly scrutinizing the whole constitution, structure, and habits of each creature, favoring the good and rejecting the bad. I can see no limit to this power, in slowly and beautifully adapting each form to the most complex relations of life. Charles Darwin, Origin, page 469. The second point to notice in Darwin's summary is that he presents his principle as deducible by a formal argument. If the conditions are met, a certain outcome is assured. Here is the summary again, with some key terms emphasized. If, during the long course of ages and under varying conditions of life, organic beings vary at all in the several parts of their organization, and I think this cannot be disputed, if there be, owing to the high geometric powers of increase of each species at some age, season, or year, a severe struggle for life, and this certainly cannot be disputed, then, considering the infinite complexity of the relations of all organic beings to each other and to their conditions of existence, causing an infinite diversity in structure, constitution, and habits to be advantageous to them, I think it would be a most extraordinary fact if no variation ever had occurred useful to each being's own welfare, in the same way as so many variations have occurred useful to man. But if variations useful to any organic being do occur, assuredly individuals thus characterized will have the best chance of being preserved in the struggle for life, and from the strong principle of inheritance, they will tend to produce offspring similarly characterized. This principle of preservation I have called, for the sake of brevity, natural selection. Origin, page 127. The basic deductive argument is short and sweet, but Darwin himself described Origin of Species as one long argument. That is because it consists of two sorts of demonstrations. The logical demonstration that a certain sort of process would necessarily have a certain sort of outcome, and the empirical demonstration that the requisite conditions for that sort of process had, in fact, been met in nature. He bolsters up his logical demonstration with thought experiments, imaginary instances, Origin, page 95, that show how the meeting of these conditions might actually account for the effects he claimed to be explaining. But his whole argument extends to book length because he presents a wealth of hard-won empirical detail to convince the reader that these conditions have been met over and over again. Stephen Jay Gould, in 1985, gives us a fine glimpse of the importance of this feature of Darwin's argument in an anecdote about Patrick Matthew, a Scottish naturalist who, as a matter of curious historical fact, had scooped Darwin's account of natural selection by many years in an appendix to his 1831 book, Naval Timber and Arboriculture. In the wake of Darwin's ascent to fame, Matthew published a letter in Gardner's Chronicle proclaiming his priority, which Darwin graciously conceded, excusing his ignorance by noting the obscurity of Matthew's choice of venue. Responding to Darwin's published apology, Matthew wrote, "To me, the conception of this law of nature came intuitively as a self-evident fact, almost without an effort of concentrated thought. Mr. Darwin here seems to have more merit in the discovery than I have had. To me, it did not appear a discovery. He seems to have worked it out by inductive reason, slowly, and with due caution, to have made his way, synthetically, from fact to fact onwards. While with me, it was by a general glance at the scheme of nature that I estimated this select production of species as an a priori recognizable fact, an axiom, requiring only to be pointed out to be admitted by unprejudiced minds of sufficient grasp, quoted in Gould, 1985, pages 345 to 46. Unprejudiced minds may well resist a new idea out of sound conservatism, however. Deductive arguments are notoriously treacherous. What seems to stand to reason can be betrayed by an overlooked detail. Darwin appreciated that only a relentlessly detailed survey of the evidence for the historical processes he was postulating would, or should, persuade scientists to abandon their traditional convictions and take on his revolutionary vision, even if it was, in fact, deducible from first principles. From the outset, there were those who viewed Darwin's novel mixture of detailed naturalism and abstract reasoning about processes as a dubious and inviolable hybrid. It had a tremendous air of plausibility, but so do many get-rich-quick schemes that turn out to be empty tricks. Compare it to the following stock market principle: buy low, sell high. This is guaranteed to make you wealthy. You cannot fail to get rich if you follow this advice. Why doesn't it work? It does work, for everybody who is fortunate enough to act according to it. But alas, there is no way of determining that the conditions are met until it is too late to act on them. Darwin was offering a skeptical world what we might call a get-rich-slow scheme, a scheme for creating design out of chaos without the aid of mind. The theoretical power of Darwin's abstract scheme was due to several features that Darwin quite firmly identified and appreciated better than many of his supporters, but lacked the terminology to describe explicitly. Today, we could capture these features under a single term. Darwin had discovered the power of an algorithm. An algorithm is a certain sort of formal process that can be counted on, logically, to yield a certain sort of result whenever it is run or instantiated. Algorithms are not new, and were not new in Darwin's day. Many familiar arithmetic procedures, such as long division or balancing your checkbook, are algorithms, and so are the decision procedures for playing perfect tic-tac-toe and for putting a list of words into alphabetical order. What is relatively new, permitting us valuable hindsight on Darwin's discovery, is the theoretical reflection by mathematicians and logicians on the nature and power of algorithms in general, a 20th century development which led to the birth of the computer, which has led, in turn, of course, to a much deeper and more lively understanding of the powers of algorithms in general. The term algorithm descends, via Latin, algorismus, to early English, algorisme, and, mistakenly therefrom, algorithm, from the name of a Persian mathematician, Musa al-Khawarizmi, whose book on arithmetical procedures, written about 835 AD, was translated into Latin in the 12th century by Adelard of Bath or Robert of Chester. The idea that an algorithm is a foolproof and somehow mechanical procedure has been present for centuries, but it was the pioneering work of Alan Turing, Kurt Gödel, and Alonzo Church in the 1930s that more or less fixed our current understanding of the term. Three key figures of algorithms will be important to us, and each is somewhat difficult to define. Each, moreover, has given rise to confusions and anxieties that continue to beset our thinking about Darwin's revolutionary discovery. So we will have to revisit and reconsider these introductory characterizations several times before we are through. 1. Substrate neutrality. The procedure for long division works equally well with pencil or pen, paper or parchment, neon lights or skywriting, using any symbol system you like. The power of the procedure is due to its logical structure, not the causal powers of the materials used in the instantiation. just so long as those causal powers permit the prescribed steps to be followed exactly. 2. Underlying mindlessness. Although the overall design of the procedure may be brilliant or yield brilliant results, each constituent step, as well as the transition between steps, is utterly simple. How simple? Simple enough for a dutiful idiot to perform, or for a straightforward mechanical device to perform. The standard textbook analogy notes that algorithms are recipes of sorts, designed to be followed by novice cooks. A recipe book written for great chefs might include the phrase, "Poach the fish in a suitable wine until almost done." But an algorithm for the same process might begin, "Choose a white wine that says dry on the label. Take a corkscrew and open the bottle. Pour an inch of wine in the bottom of a pan. Turn the burner under the pan on high." A tedious breakdown of the process into dead simple steps, requiring no wise decisions or delicate judgments or intuitions on the part of the recipe reader. 3. Guaranteed results. Whatever it is that an algorithm does, it always does it, if it is executed without misstep. An algorithm is a foolproof recipe. It is easy to see how these features made the computer possible. Every computer program is an algorithm, ultimately composed of simple steps that can be executed with stupendous reliability by one simple mechanism or another. Electronic circuits are the usual choice, but the power of computers owes nothing, save speed, to the causal peculiarities of electrons darting about on silicon chips. The very same algorithms can be performed even faster by devices shunting photons in glass fibers, or much, much slower, by teams of people using paper and pencil. And as we shall discuss, the capacity of computers to run algorithms with tremendous speed and reliability is now permitting theoreticians to explore Darwin's dangerous idea in ways heretofore impossible, with fascinating results. What Darwin discovered was not really one algorithm, but rather a large class of related algorithms that he had no clear way to distinguish. We can now reformulate his fundamental idea as follows. Life on Earth has been generated over billions of years in a single branching tree, the tree of life, by one algorithmic process or another. What this claim means will become clear gradually as we sort through the various ways people have tried to express it. In some versions, it is utterly vacuous and uninformative. In others, it is manifestly false. In between lie the versions that really do explain the origin of species and promise to explain much else besides. These versions are becoming clearer all the time, thanks as much to the determined criticisms of those who frankly hate the idea of evolution as an algorithm, as to the rebuttals of those who love it. 5. Processes as algorithms. When theorists think of algorithms, they often have in mind kinds of algorithms with properties that are not shared by the algorithms that will concern us. When mathematicians think about algorithms, for instance, they usually have in mind algorithms that can be proven to compute particular mathematical functions of interest to them. Long division is a homely example. A procedure for breaking down a huge number into its prime factors is one that attracts attention in the exotic world of cryptography. But the algorithms that will concern us have nothing particular to do with the number system or other mathematical objects. They are algorithms for sorting, winnowing, and building things. Because most mathematical discussions of algorithms focus on their guaranteed or mathematically provable powers, people sometimes make the elementary mistake of thinking that a process that makes use of chance or randomness is not an algorithm. But even long division makes good use of randomness. For example, 326,574 divided by 47. Does the divisor go into the dividend 6 or 7 or 8 times? Who knows? Who cares? You don't have to know. You don't have to have any wits or discernment to do long division. The algorithm directs you just to choose a digit, at random if you like, and check out the result. If the chosen number turns out to be too small, increase it by one and start over. If too large, decrease it. The good thing about long division is that it always works, eventually, even if you are maximally stupid in making your first choice, in which case it just takes a little longer. Achieving success on hard tasks, in spite of utter stupidity, is what makes computers seem magical. How could something as mindless as a machine do something as smart as that? Not surprisingly, then, the tactic of finessing ignorance by randomly generating a candidate and then testing it out mechanically is a ubiquitous feature of interesting algorithms. Not only does it not interfere with their provable powers as algorithms, it is often the key to their power. See Dennett, 1984, pages 149 to 52, on the particularly interesting powers of Michael Rabin's random algorithms, available in the downloadable PDF. We can begin zeroing in on the phylum of evolutionary algorithms by considering everyday algorithms that share important properties with them. Darwin draws our attention to repeated waves of competition and selection. So consider the standard algorithm for organizing an elimination tournament, such as a tennis tournament, which eventually culminates with quarterfinals, semifinals, and then a final, determining the solitary winner. Notice that this procedure meets the three conditions. It is the same procedure whether drawn in chalk on a blackboard or updated in a computer file or, a weird possibility, not written down anywhere, but simply enforced by building a huge fan of fenced-off tennis courts, each with two entrance gates and a single exit gate, leading the winner to the court where the next match is to be played. The losers are shot and buried where they fall. It doesn't take a genius to march the contestants through the drill, filling in the blanks at the end of each match, or identifying and shooting the losers. And it always works. But what exactly does this algorithm do? It takes, as input, a set of competitors and guarantees to terminate by identifying a single winner. But what is a winner? It all depends on the competition. Suppose the tournament in question is not tennis, but coin tossing. One player tosses and the other